What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast live at SPATS 2016. This will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/JimmyGonzalezSPATS16. So we're interviewing Dr. Jimmy Gonzalez. He talked about skin infections. And also have John. I kind of just coerced him into joining us today. He was going to ask Dr. Gonzalez a question, but since his question is a question from an athletic trainer, I'm sure we could all benefit from hearing his question and answer. So, John, why don't we go ahead and start off with your question for Dr. Gonzalez.
I was just listening to your talk and wondering what physiologically, you know, what chemical reactions in the body would cause exercise-induced asphyxia.
Anaphylaxis. So those are the histaminic reactions in the body. So it's basically when your body, it's similar to that fight-and-flight response and the sympathetic tone. Something like we're talking to, like the cholinergic reactions, those types of things. And your body just has that, it's, as far as describing it, it's like an allergic reaction. And so your body has this, and it's either the exercise that does it, it can be the heat that kind of tips you over the scale, but it basically reacts like an allergic reaction. And then that's where you have that reaction, where you have that edema. Again, it starts with that itchiness. If you think of anybody that's got a food allergy, it starts the exact same way. It starts with the itchiness, that kind of red rash. Then they start having the puffy eyes, the angioedema, the swelling of the eyelids, the lips, and that's when it moves into the full-blown anaphylactic reaction. That's where it goes. As far as the exact trigger, I can't tell you.
So on that, is there any, besides them having an episode, is there any way to tell that beforehand?
Usually not. It's usually when they've had something similar. When we talked about the urticaria, the solar urticaria, those types of things, with the cholinergic urticaria, those can be some of the precursors. And that's why we would like to have those tested to make sure that, okay, yes, it is the solar urticaria, or basically hives from the sun, as opposed to the early stages of an exercise-induced anaphylaxis. And so when they have something like that, we can have them tested, and again, tested in a monitored environment, something that can be, should they go into an anaphylactic reaction, that's something that can be treated and handled appropriately.
All right. So one of the things you can say, all right. So one of the things in the very beginning, you talked about lacerations, and you said those need to be closed, sutured. So what are the criteria for us just steri-stripping those versus needing to get stitches?
So steri-stripping is a good temporary measure. I don't know that I would keep anything that is under tension with a steri-strip. Now, if it's something small that doesn't, again, size is one of the criteria. If it's smaller than a couple of centimeters, then it could potentially be held by some steri-strips and some benzoin. But again, you have to have that adhesive in order to get a good seal. You want the edges approximated. You don't want to have a lot of bleeding. If there's bleeding, if there's any tension on the wound, or if the wound edges are separating out, then you're going to want to have something permanent there. You're going to want to have some sutures. Sutures can help with hemostasis. They're a little bit more permanent. They can last a little bit longer, depending on, again, where it is. On the face, those are usually healing up within about 5 days or so. Something on the trunk or the back can be up to 10 to 14 days. So, again, the time frame also makes a difference. So where the lesion is, or whether I should say the laceration is, will also determine, hey, do I need to put some sutures in here, because steri-strips just won't last that long.
Okay, so I have a kid who has about a 1-inch laceration on the face, maybe above the eyebrow. That's really common. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, okay, I'm going to go ahead and apply pressure, stop the bleeding, and then kind of wipe him clean, put the glue on there, and then put the steri-strips. Is that okay? And then I tell them, all right, don't peel them off. You can shower, but don't peel them off. Let them fall off. Is that normal?
Yeah. As long as there's not a lot of tension on there, I think that should be okay. You're gonna have a hard time getting those steri-strips, depending on the proximity to the eyebrow. And again, those lacerations in those areas bleed a lot. So any kind of facial or scalp lacerations bleed a lot, and so those are typically going to be something that are sutured. But if it's something in the middle of a game and something like that, you can throw some Steri-Strips on there, get them to halftime, but I would probably suture that up and kind of keep that. Again, you get good hemostasis, you get good approximation of the wounds. So I don't typically lean on Steri-Strips very often. It's more of a temporary measure. Sometimes you can use the cyanoacrylate or like the skin glue. That's again for small lacerations. And I would say that's probably more an appropriate closure than just using Steri-Strips. I still think of Steri-Strips as a temporary closure until we can get them to something that's more definitive.
All right, so you're saying Steri-Strip and then at halftime get them stitches, but we as athletic trainers, honestly, I don't know of any of athletic trainers that are qualified or have the certification to do stitches.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I see you got a UTRGV shirt on, and so you're working with the college, but at the high school level, for the most part, we're not going to mm-hmm. have a doctor to do stitches or a doctor with a stitch kit on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. So at that point, do I allow him to finish the game and then send him right afterwards, or do I need to send him right away? Because is there
I think allowing them to finish the game would be fine. Again, as long as you have good hemostasis, as long as you've got control of the wound and it's not going to open up and you can pat it and protect it to keep it from getting re-injured, I think that should be fine as long as it's closed up and then have it, again, definitively taken care of afterwards.
And now, is there a time frame after 2 hours of the wound being open the stitches won't work or anything like that?
There is a time frame, and it's about 6 to 8 hours. Again, anything that's going to be open longer than about half a day, you start worrying about things getting in, infection setting in, and I typically won't close things. Again, if I get something that, hey, I had this happen yesterday or the day before, yeah, I'm not going to close that up. So again, immediately you can let them finish, let them do whatever they need to do. You've controlled the wound, you've controlled the bleeding, and then you can get it definitively taken care of. But as far as, again, oh yeah, go in a few days, then you probably wouldn't suture that up.
Yeah, or don't wait till the morning to see, because then that's roughly 8 hours anyways. So, all right, because yeah, we've always said, you know, if you don't go get the stitches right now, then you can't get stitches, and I just wanted to make sure that I was still correct.
So. Yeah. So same day.
All right, and you mentioned Acne Mechanica, and so that's, you know, a lot of times you'll see with the face, with the chin strap on football. Is there any way to tell the difference between, because a normal 14-year-old boy might have terrible acne and you can't tell any difference. Is there any way to tell the difference?
It would be mainly in the area or where it's coming up. Again, Acne Mechanica is very similar to acne vulgaris, which is just general acne. It's treated the same way, but again, if it's coming from either the chin strap or the ear pads on the helmet or the forehead pad, then it's going to be in that location. You're going to be able to kind of match it up with whatever's sitting right on top of the skin. It's almost like that dermatitis picture where you can see the outline of the sandals coming out. You can see almost the outline of that chin strap with the acne in those areas that are being occluded by the equipment.
And then you said one of the things you can do is clean the equipment. Obviously, you said not every day, but what do you recommend? Bleach water or one of those commercially available locker room cleanser things?
I think either one of those would be fine. Just making sure that you're cleaning the equipment, getting all the bacteria off. And again, like I said, every day is probably not feasible. But doing it regularly to kind of keep it as clean as possible.
So if the kid, say I have an alcohol wipe or like a sani wipe, whatever, and the kids come by after practice, grab that, wipe their chin strap out, hang it in their locker, would that be effective?
I think that would suffice, yes.
So if I have a kid with that, then I can just say, hey, just come by every day and grab this, or just have that all that pimply stuff on your face, you pick. That should work.
Yep.
Hopefully they'll do that. All right, I've never seen Black Heel. Until you saw it up there. I don't think I've even actually heard of it, you know, except for like the Black Hill Mountains, but that's a different heel. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
So again, Black Heel is basically from a chronic heel strike. So usually in runners that are having these constant strikes on the heels, and they're small little hematomas that coalesce. And so it's an accumulation of blood under the skin, And so it looks like a black dot from the dry, once the blood dries. Initially, it'll look a little bit red, almost like a blood blister. But what happens is the blood dries, and that gives it its black color.
So it's essentially a busted blood blister.
It's small, several blood vessels that have been injured.
Okay, and then you said that'll normally resolve on its own once the activity has stopped.
Yes. You can do some padding, some heel cups, those types of things in order to prevent it from happening. But once it's happened, the skin's got to grow out, and that layer's got to come out, and it'll resolve.
And you said that's normally in runners, like distance runners?
Yes.
So I wouldn't normally see that in a football player?
Not typically. I wouldn't expect it. I mean, now it's something that if you saw it again, it would be treated the same way. But I would see typically runners that are going to have these hundreds and thousands of heel strikes as they're running through hard surfaces.
And would that be more likely in a, say, like, I'm 220 pounds. If I was running, would it be more likely in me if I was running miles, or because I have a 90-pound, maybe 90-pound girl that just got a college scholarship. So is it any difference?
Yes.
In the two?
Yeah, I think there's a correlation with weight. And obviously, you're going to have more trauma with every impact. So the heavier the runner, the more likelihood you're going to have of that type of injury.
Okay. I'm consulting my questions here. All right. I remember the first time I saw somebody drill a nail for subingual hematoma. And what they did was they got the finger numb and then took that little drill thing and put that little hole in. And I saw the blood just, not like shooting, but, you know, just spurting out of the thing. And that's still normal. Like I was going to ask you that question, but then later in your slide, you said, yeah, you just stick a needle in there or drill it or whatever. So is that something that's okay for athletic trainers to do in the athletic training room?
I think so. Again, the whole idea is relieving the pain. When they have those subungual hematomas, they're extremely painful because it is under pressure. And I think that's something, again, you're able to clean off the nail, you're able to do that stuff as long as you have a sterile needle and you're not introducing bacteria into that environment. I think that's something that should be okay for athletic trainers to do in the training room. And again, once it's done, you're going to evacuate the hematoma, cover it up, and get it dressed and protected.
All right, so you said 18-gauge needle. What happens if it's smaller or larger?
A smaller needle is going to have a hard time because the needle is actually a little bit more, the longer the needle is, if it's very thin, it's going to be very flexible. And so you're going to have a harder time drilling with that because of the pressure that you're putting on there. A larger bore needle, again, you're going to make a little bit bigger hole, but again, I don't think that makes that big of a difference because it's just that point that's going to get through. And then once you have that small hole, the blood will come out because it's under pressure. So 18-gauge is what we typically use just because that's a standardized needle that is typically used in both emergency bags and medical equipment on EMS. That's kind of a standardized needle. We use 18-gauges as a very common gauge.
All right. And then you said evacuate the hematoma. So just gently pressing from like the outside end, does it matter?
Yeah, and again, once you relieve the pressure, and it'll evacuate on its own. You don't really have to press too much. You can press a little bit to see if there's any extra blood that'll come out. But again, it's the blood it's already separated the nail from the nail bed. And so once you relieve the pressure, then that should be enough, and then you can just dress it.
Okay. And any special concerns in doing that? So in the procedure of, you know, how do you make sure you get just as soon as you start to see blood leak, that's when you stop drilling?
Yeah, as soon as you can relieve that pressure, then you're relieving the pressure that's causing the pain, and that should be enough. So okay. Once you see that, you know when to stop.
And then once it's clean, any just like a normal wound?
Yeah, you'll dress it like a normal wound. You'll keep it covered. And like we talked about during the presentation, nails take quite a long while to grow out. So you're going to see that hole migrate towards the distal nail. And depending on how long the hematoma has been present and how much of the nail was involved, the athlete may actually lose the nail. So you may see the new nail grow underneath the old one, depending on how much of it was involved.
All right. Something similar. Blisters, you said it's best to leave those intact, if at all possible, prevent infection. Why is it best to leave those intact?
So what happens is you're basically having fluid accumulation between the dermis and the epidermis. So what happens is you have a separation of those layers. Once you take that epidermis off, it's basically like an open wound. You've got to keep it protected. You have a pathway for bacteria to get in. If you can leave that intact, then that skin provides a natural bandage, and it keeps the integrity of the skin intact, which is what the skin does. I mean, that's its normal function, is to keep bacteria out, one of the normal functions. So if we can leave it intact as the skin underneath grows, or should I say as the blister underneath grows and heals, then you have a perfect bacterial barrier.
Right. We had this conversation at some point on a Facebook group, and they mentioned like sticking a needle with like fishing line through the blister so that it can drain, but it keeps the blister from closing, but only has a tiny hole to help prevent infection. Do you have any?
I wouldn't leave anything foreign in there, because that leaving a line, it's essentially the same concept as a suture, but if you're using a fishing line, again, it's not sterile. You're introducing a pathway for a bacteria to be introduced into that environment, which is exactly the opposite of what we're trying to accomplish by leaving the skin on there. So if you're leaving kind of a pathway for something to get in, I would probably just leave the hole. Once it closes up, a little bit of fluid in there is okay. It's just kind of relieving the pressure and kind of getting that skin to approximate back to the bottom of the blister.
All right. So maybe possibly if you're using sterile suture string, but even at that, if you're going through all that. Then...
Yeah, even at that, I think you're still leaving a track for bacteria to get in.
And then you talked about cutting toenails, and actually, like when I just cut my toe, I got kind of fat toes, right? And so the normal toenail clippers, I can't do it in one cut. I have to make two cuts, or it's only gets one half. So how can I best? I understand like the middle should be like, I guess, the shortest part, and the edges should be a little bit slightly longer, or they say straight across. But I just can't make a straight cut with that one toenail
clipper. And so ideally, you're gonna want it straight across. When you're cutting the nails, you want to be able to see the corner of the nail. So if you're thinking of the distal nail or the end that would be touching the shoe, and you think of that corner that touches the lateral side, you want to be able to see that corner. So you don't want that corner to be diving under the nail fold on the lateral side or on the medial side, or should I say on the side of the toe. So if you can cut it, again, not necessarily straight across, but to where that corner is not buried in the skin, then that usually will give you enough of a protection to keep it from going in and causing an ingrown toenail.
And just leaving just a little bit of overhang past the...
Mm-hmm. Right. A little bit of an overhang. Or if they are short, some of the things that we talked about is using a piece of dental floss to keep it under the corner of the nail, or a piece of cotton.
All right. And since it's not an open wound, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the blisters.
Yes.
Now, I also heard, you know, if you have it to where it's starting to dig under, you can cut a V out of the center, and that'll help relieve some of the pressure and grow in. That's not correct.
That I'm not sure of. What we typically do in a clinic setting is we do a wedge, but it's out of the lateral side. So we will take the corner that's going in. I don't think that cutting a V would relieve the pressure in the sense that you would expect it to, because the lateral part that's already growing out is growing. It's not growing straight. It's growing out into the nail fold. And so it's being pushed
really
in there
like
by the skin.
You're making
that it's
me into a liar.
Into.
See,
so I don't think that would just relieving the pressure in the center wouldn't
right.
pull it back.
Joggers' nipples. that's a really gross picture that you showed. and so with that, you
I gave a warning. I gave a warning ahead of time.
Vaseline or Band-Aid or something that's going to take care of that.
Some kind of barrier. I've seen runners even here at the South Padre Island Marathon using Band-Aids on the nipples. We had Vaseline stations towards the middle to the later portion of the race. Any kind of barrier or protectant. Running without a shirt. Using some of the dry fit type materials as opposed to a cotton
showed,
shirt.
But
again,
it looked
can
like
get
that
heavy
guy.
And
I mean,
very abrasive.
It looked like he was wearing
those
some
are
sort
all
of dry
measures
fit
that
shirt.
Can be taken to prevent that. Yeah, it was. I think it was a dry fit shirt that he was wearing, but again, even with that, those are things that you can make it less of a risk. But if you're running 26 miles, if you're doing an ultra marathon, something like that, again, you're running these long, long distances.
Now, running
I think anything that's going to be rubbing
on
there, whether it be dry fit
or
anything
Texas,
otherwise,
there's a huge
can cause
temperature
that
difference. Would that make any difference in specifically the joggers, Nichols?
I think it would make a difference in the area that how much perspiration is going on. Because it, obviously if you're wearing something like a cotton shirt, the more you perspire, the more abrasive the material becomes. And so again, if you're not sweating as much or you're in a cooler climate,
right,
then I think
then,
you could have more
I
longevity.
I didn't catch the second word, but it was
running
physiogenic. It was basically
like
when the
happen.
Fat is, or the physiogenic papules. And then just describe that because I'm struggling for the words right now.
Yeah, piezogenic papules. Yes. Okay. So basically what that is there are small outpouchings of fat through the small tissue layer that surrounds the heel. And so you've got a layer of fascia, basically, that goes around the heel. And what that is kind of like a tissue layer, and it's a small connective tissue layer that is usually like a flat sheet. Once you have a weakness in the layer and you have a little herniation out through the side, so basically a little piece of fat can pop out, and it looks like a little nodule. And that's why it's only seen when athletes or patients are standing,
right,
because you're having
you
enough
you
pressure to push the fat out of that
it.
Little weakness.
Now, the only thing I
can
think of
that,
would be like kinesio tape
that tissue layer.
But how would you tape?
So doing a tape around the heel to where the tape is able to keep the pressure in. So if you think of almost like a hernia, or if you think of like a water balloon that is poking out of a hole, if you cover the hole as much as you push on there, then that water balloon can't, or whatever it is, can't push out of that little hole. So you're basically splinting it the same way using the tape around the heel where those papules are coming out. And again, it's more for treatment of the pain. And these are typically asymptomatic, and they usually only cause pain when some of the little dermal nerves are involved.
Right.
But that would be some of the thing, or one of the treatments that I would try.
There was quite a few
if they are having pain.
There, I think there's three or four of them. Is there a way to tell the difference besides? I know you said the sandals or the necklace, like you can tell because there's a specific outline. Mm-hmm. But then there was a couple of them where you showed like the back or the whole body kind of thing.
Yeah. Urticaria is a generic term for hives. And again, hives are those wheals that everybody sees. And the difference is just the offending factor. So whether it's solar urticaria and it's the sun, or it's cold urticaria and the offending factor is cold temperatures, the difference between them is basically
so
what's causing it.
Cholinergic.
It's not the way the lesions
appear. I think you said
appear.
That one is
it's the inciting
like an emergency
factor.
I don't know about Rusty, but it's a...
Mm-hmm. So the cholinergic urticaria, again, it can be with exercise, it can be with heat, it can be stress induced, because any of those things, even eating spicy foods, can cause a cholinergic release in the body. So it's not always an allergic reaction. But again, having those urticaria, so hives are considered a precursor or a possible precursor to anaphylaxis. So it's similar in the way when somebody reacts to a medication. If they have a small rash, it's not as serious as, okay, they had a hive-type reaction. So if they're having hives, then we think, okay, that could potentially be a precursor to anaphylaxis.
And was that the one that you talked about?
Because, again,
they can take
that's
like a shower to cause that reaction before?
To a full anaphylactic,
yeah, that was pretty cool.
Reaction.
So, but again, you'd have to know what it is and the symptoms and stuff like that. So,
the cholinergic
And then when you were talking about MRSA, you said cosmetic shaving. Now, you're a clean-shaven guy,
yes,
right? So to me, that's cosmetic shaving. So how do you define cosmetic shaving?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So any kind of cosmetic shaving, again, I would consider facial shaving, cosmetic shaving, shaving your legs, shaving your arms, those types of things. All of that can be recommended. Now, Staph aureus in general is a bacteria that people typically have on their body, and it enters the body or enters the skin from any kind of micro lesions that can happen. So if they have somebody that's prone to these types of infections, again, that would be one of the recommendations, is to not do something like that as far as shaving. You can also use, again, if it's something that, hey, I've got to shave my face, I can't have a beard, or whatever, whatever their need is, there can be other things. There are nasal or antibiotic ointments that you can put that we can use to kind of eradicate the MRSA from if they're in a carrier state. So if we know that somebody's a carrier, they usually will carry it in their nose. And it's a regimen of antibiotic ointments that can eradicate that and hopefully get rid of that bacteria. So again, it's one of the recommendations to prevent these from occurring. But if it's something that they need to do, there are other measures that we can take with antibacterial soaps, antibacterial washes, with there's one like Hiba Cleanse or anything with chlorhexidine.
Yeah, how can someone be prone?
Those are all good antibacterial
MRSA
washes that can help clean off the bacteria. Prone would be exposure. Staph aureus, like I said, in and of itself is kind of ubiquitous everywhere, but the methicillin resistant is becoming more common in healthcare and that kind of environment. So I would say anybody that's had, I would say probably the training rooms, or anybody that's going into the training room is going to have exposure probably to MRSA. Anybody that has exposure to healthcare, and healthcare not just being hospitals, doctor's offices, nursing homes, anything like that. All of those can be areas where MRSA can be acquired. So it's becoming more and more common. When we see boils and those types of things, we treat them as MRSA.
I remember when I was a kid, we'd just swim in the lake, and then sometimes we ended up with what my parents called boils. I don't know if it was MRSA. I don't know if we went. I don't remember going to the doctor. I just remember having like a big nasty thing on our leg, but either here or there. Dr. Jimmy Gonzalez, it'll be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/JimmyGonzalezSpat16. Right, Jasmine? All right. Fellow Aggies here. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/JimmyGonzalezSpats16. That's where you'll be able to find this episode, and I'll have a link to his talk as well. So Dr. Gonzalez, thank you.